All courses of action are risky, so prudence is not in avoiding danger. It is impossible, but in calculating risk and acting decisively. Those are the words of Niccolo Machiavelli, who is the lodestar of statecraft and leadership, which is the theme of this year's Engelsberg seminars. I'm Paul Lay, senior editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm joined by Alistair Benn, deputy editor at EI, and to discuss what we get right and what we get wrong about the lodestar that is Machiavelli, we're joined by one of the world's leading authorities on the great statecraft master. And that is Alexander Lee, Dr. Alexander Lee of the University of Warwick, who is a biographer, acclaimed biographer of Machiavelli. And he joins us in this lovely rural setting in Sweden, which is Engelsberg. Now, Alexander, what do we get right and what do we get wrong about Machiavelli? First of all, what do we get wrong?
What do we get wrong? Well, thanks very much for having me to start with. What do we get wrong about Machiavelli? Well, we all have an image of Machiavelli, I think, as this great master of political chicanery.
The dark arts.
The dark arts, exactly. He's haunted by that judgment of Cardinal Reginald Pole on the Prince. And Pole said that it seemed to have been written by Satan's hand. And the reason that Pole said that was because of Machiavelli's whole approach to the question of what makes a good prince or a good leader. And Machiavelli was not, in fact, as Pole suggested, advocating something that was completely amoral, let alone immoral. Mm. What he was saying was that before he came along, humanists had tended to approach the question of leadership and the good prince from the perspective of virtue. In order to be a good ruler, in order to win the approval and the favour of your subjects, you needed to embody those same moral qualities which are expected of everybody. Stoic Christian virtues of prudence, temperance, fortitude, hope, faith, etc., etc. And Machiavelli said, well, actually, no, that's all hogwash, really. And he said that it was hogwash because it imposed constraints on a leader as they tried to operate in a very confusing world. He said, Fortune, whom he pictured as a woman, has no regard for good or bad. She delivers her favour or her disfavour simply on the basis of her whims. If you try to act always on the basis of virtue, when you are surrounded by men who are fallible, weak, sometimes good, sometimes, more often perhaps, bad, then you are going to come a cropper. You are limiting your options. And so Machiavelli said it's more important to know how not to be good. He didn't mean that in the sense of how to be wicked, but rather how and when to depart from the normal bounds of morality in practicing statecraft, in ruling a state. So, to return directly to your question, what do we get wrong? He's not saying a prince should be, you know, an immoral person, not saying that they should have no regard for morality whatsoever, but they should know when it's appropriate to depart from that that way of operating, to know when it's appropriate to be dishonest, when keeping your word would put you in a disadvantageous position, to know when compassion might be dangerous, when compassion might encourage your enemies to rebel, when it is more appropriate to be cruel without arousing hatred, to know when it is best to be a bit penny-pinching rather than generous. So he's not suggesting an amoral model of statecraft. He's not writing a book, he's not producing a book that could have been written by Satan's hand. He's just saying, in the real world, where people are fickle, you have to give yourself a free hand to operate as the circumstances demand.
And is this, in a sense, a realpolitik?
Well, it's often said that Machiavelli's great contribution to theories of statecraft and leadership is his abandonment of idealism for realism. That may be slightly it may be a slight exaggeration to say that he is the absolute first person to start thinking in these terms, but he's certainly someone who does it very effectively and perhaps more completely than anyone else before. I mean, experience is coming to be a more and more important criterion of judgment, as opposed to authority, for example, or other abstract principles in this period. But it's Machiavelli who really takes it forward. He's interested in looking things square in the face, evaluating how a political situation really stands, where the threats really lie, and how one should act according to necessity, not according to an idealized view of how we'd like things to be. Necessity is a very, very important concept for Machiavelli.
And Machiavelli is very much the product of the violent, turbulent world of 16th century Florence, well, 15th and 16th century Florence. But I was struck by a comment made at the seminars by John Bew, who is, of course, the senior foreign policy advisor to Number 10, when he was asked, you know, what's a good reading list for people who want to practice statecraft, to learn statecraft, you know, what are the key texts? And along with Marx and Burke and various other people, he named Machiavelli, the prince. Why has it retained this power? It seems to be eternally resonant and relevant in a way that almost no other 16th century work is. I mean, I may be wrong there. You may have opinions of those that are competing there. I can think of a 17th century work like Leviathan, for instance, Hobbes' Leviathan, that retains that kind of resonance. I'm struggling to think of a 16th century one. But what is it about it that still captures the intention and actually makes it a practical tool for policymakers, diplomats, statesmen, politicians, whatever?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's the prince is at the top of most people's reading lists on leadership and statecraft. In fact, Napoleon once said, or is supposed to have said, that it was the only book worth reading. Now, that may be apocryphal, but nevertheless testifies to the perception that you were talking about. And it's true that it achieves this status very, very soon after its appearance and quite quickly after Machiavelli's death. It isn't published in his lifetime. It appears in print shortly afterwards. And I think that in some senses it is a little bit surprising, because we have to remember, and it's often forgotten, that The Prince was written with the challenges of Florence in mind. It was dedicated to Lorenzo di Piero de' Medici, and it was intended to really show Lorenzo how, having returned to Florence after more than 20 years or about 20 years in exile, they could his family could shore up their position, even though they'd benefited from luck and the military assistance of others. So it's a bit surprising, because it is written with a very, 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 very specific context in mind. But it's a book which I think is remarkable and attracts attention for a variety of reasons. Number one, we've already mentioned the fact that it is the first book really to put as it's a realpolitik, but certainly a realistic assessment of politics at the forefront of analysis, to make what is actually the case the primary criterion of political action and necessity alongside it. Secondly, although his views and his advice is tailored to a highly specific circumstance, it is written in a very kind of expansive way, and many of the principles that he discusses that I mentioned a while ago, you know, the preference of dishonesty over honesty, a willingness to be parsimonious rather than generous, and a readiness to be cruel rather than merciful, are ideas that one can very, very easily read into other areas of leadership. They appear to be very adaptable. Another reason why I think it did achieve a degree of renown is that it's also very accessible, very easy to read. People often forget that Machiavelli is a very, very enjoyable writer.
Yeah. So it's a work of art as well as a work of politics.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, don't forget, Machiavelli also wrote poetry, plays, short stories.
A Renaissance man.
A very, very well put. Yes, he is a Renaissance man. But the main reason is, for its initial impact, is its departure from previous modes of approaching politics. And that really does attract attention. I think it also benefits from controversy as well, because it was quickly recognised as departing from a moralistic view of politics. It was quickly both admired and condemned by people pretty quickly. And in the wars of religion, you find it being used by both sides.
By both Protestant and Catholic.
Precisely.
I thought that was a really interesting point, actually.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Yeah. And that, of course, I think, of our more controversial leaders today, no, a bit of controversy certainly doesn't do any harm.
Are there unlikely contexts in which Machiavelli has been read widely, sort of in the world in general? It's a bit like Sun Tzu, isn't it? The Art of War. It's so widely diffused. And, you know, from CEOs to sportsmen, read Sun Tzu to get... goals and insights into what they're doing. I mean, I don't know how applicable it is. But are there periods, number one, where people read it in unlikely ways? And two, are there also periods when Machiavelli falls completely out of fashion and becomes just something that people don't think applies to them?
No, I don't think Machiavelli ever goes... Well, The Prince ever goes out of fashion. Some of his other works come and go in popularity, but The Prince has been pretty consistent. But you're absolutely right that even today Machiavelli is read in very unusual ways from an historian's perspective. Every year, as I mentioned the other day, a mass of new books appears which suggests applying Machiavelli to yet another area. There's a lot of books applying Machiavelli to business. There's one that came out a little while ago about Machiavelli for women, et cetera, et cetera. And they're a good testimony to his status as the lodestar of leadership and statecraft. Whether they are stretching their readings a little bit, I leave for others to judge.
And what about the personality of Machiavelli? You are a biographer of Machiavelli. I mean, what is your opinion of the man himself? There seems to be something quite elusive about him in a way. Elusive and elusive, I suppose you could say.
Well, I have a soft spot for Machiavelli. I know I'm biased, but I have a soft spot for him.
I can tell that.
I thought you might be able to. We're very lucky in that we have a very large amount of material that helps us get a sense of the man behind the Machiavellian mask, if you like. We have a very, very, very large number of private letters written by him to his friends and by his friends to him. He leaves us a very large body of diplomatic correspondence as well. And, of course, we have this very varied oeuvre of his, which extends from The Prince, the Discorsi, and the Florentine histories, right through to, as I mentioned, plays, comedies that are still performed in Italy today, a ghost story, poems to his mistress, poems from prison. He's very varied. So we can get a very clear impression of his thinking, his way of living. And I think there are two points that I would like to highlight in answering your question more directly. The first one is that Machiavelli is at the forefront of Florentine politics between being appointed as second chancellor of Florence in the late 1490s and losing his job after the Medici's return in 1512. And in that period, you can see him really straining hard to defend his homeland. Later in his life, he says he loves Florence more than life itself. Mm-hmm. He's a very committed, I'm hesitant to say a patriot, but he is very, very attached to his patria. He engages in, when he's sent on diplomatic missions, he engages in speculation as to what the thinking of other actors might be to a greater degree than many of his contemporaries in a similar position. He's constantly searching and questioning and questing. And that is, even despite enduring, in many cases, great physical hardship. There are occasions when he can't even write. So I think that kind of questing is very interesting, particularly because when he does after the Medici return to power, he loses his job, he gets thrown into prison, tortured, and then kind of left out in the cold for many years. He tries to get back, and he writes The Prince, that partly is an attempt to get back in with Florence's new masters. And in the last 14 years of his life, you see in his correspondence this profound sense of sadness, of grief, of depression, of wanting to get back in the swim. So he's a man of very strong emotions when it comes to his political life. The second point I want to make is a more general point about his character and his daily existence. It would be a grave mistake for anyone to suppose that he was as severe as his reputation might lead us to suppose. Yeah. He's actually tremendous fun. Mm. I mean, he's a fiend as well. He's a bit of a cad, but he's someone who enjoys a drink. He enjoys a good joke. His letters, his private correspondence, abounds with in-jokes, gags, funny stories, funny poems, things like that. He writes a series of verses called the Canti Carnaleschi, carnival songs, which are meant to be sung. And they're very, very funny. I mean, it's even today, even if you aren't a Renaissance chap, a Renaissance fan, reading them, it's hard to suppress a little chuckle. He's a committed family man. He marries a woman called Marietta, and there's a very great warmth between them. He's very affectionate towards his children. One of the last letters he writes, he's racing back to Florence, trying to get there before the expected arrival of the Swiss soldiers, who eventually go off to sack Rome instead. He's terrified that Florence is going to be decimated. He's terrified for his family. And one of the last letters he writes is to his son, his 12-year-old son. And he's sort of giving advice about, you know, learning, doing lessons, things like that. Mm. Talking about a donkey that's had some problems. That's not to say that he wasn't... He didn't have a wandering eye, and more than that, in fact, he had many, many affairs.
Yeah, he was quite an amorous figure, wasn't he?
Oh, a very amorous figure. And when he is out to pasture a bit and starts writing plays, he begins an affair with a much younger woman called Barbara Sarutati, and he writes some poems to her in which he gently mocks himself, saying, you know, I'm not really up to it, sorry about that.
And there's a great sense of irony in The Prince as well, isn't it? You really get that, the mischief, the irony of it, which I think makes it so readable. Mm. In a way, this is not just simply a how-to manual for the aspiring politician or the aspiring ruler. Mm. It's as you say, a work of art. Mm. It is actually a very, very enjoyable, sly, mischievous, ironic read.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you're absolutely right to emphasise his sense of irony, his mischievous sense of humour. And I think that has contributed, at least in part, to the fondness of some scholars and readers for seeing The Prince almost as a satire.
Yeah.
I'm not someone who subscribes to that reading of it, but if you acknowledge his... I don't say a wicked sense of humour, but he did have a wicked sense of humour. It's not impossible to believe or understand where one's coming from in advancing that view.
Well, I mean, the fact that John Muir, among many others, talks about this book as being recommended reading for politicians, for diplomats, for anyone interested in statecraft and leadership in the 21st century, considering it was written in the 1600s, it's half a millennia.
Sure.
Of resonance and relevance. I mean, that gives you some sense of just how important it is.
Well, absolutely.
And to a Machiavelli sort of neophyte, what do you suggest reading after The Prince, if The Prince is a good entry point?
Well, it depends, I think, what you're interested in. If you're interested in generally, when people have read The Prince, they go on to read his other great work, which is the Discorsi. The Discourses on the first decade of Livy's History of Rome. It's a much more challenging read because it's a very different type of book. It's conceived as and structured as a kind of loose commentary on a work of Roman history, which reaches out to modern politics and broader themes. And it's fascinating, and there is a big, big debate which continues to rage about the relationship between these two works, because it's more focused on how republics can preserve their greatness and their liberty. But I think if you were interested in exploring some of the key themes in Machiavelli's Prince, like the role of fortune, the need to be unbound by moral constraints, to act according to necessity, to be bold and daring. You might do better by reading some of his lesser works, which are not very well known, but very revealing. So this, The Role of Fortune, for example, is discussed in a very pithy, very pointed and interesting way in an early work called the Gheribizzi, which he writes, if memory serves, while he is following Julius II around.
That's Pope Julius.
Pope Julius II, the warrior pope. Similarly, you can see some of the ideas that he explores in The Prince, the more specific ideas like the prevalence of cruelty over kindness. In early works, like he writes a report on the affairs of Pisa, Florence at the time is trying to recapture the lost port of Pisa, vital to its trade. And this is one of the first things he writes, actually. He says, well, you know, are we going to try and win them over by being nice to them? Or should we just go in all guns? Should we go in savagely? And of course, he weighs it up in terms of, do people react better to compassion or to cruelty? And he comes down in favour of cruelty. And again, in another little report on other rebellious cities in the Val di Chiana. So those, I think, are quite accessible. They have the same snappiness, the sharpness of The Prince, the same very enjoyable style. A final one that is also quite exciting, but which gives you a glimpse into these ideas, is I won't give you the full title because it's a bit long, but it is basically a description of the means used by Cesare Borgia to deal with his rebellious captains. Cesare Borgia, another character with whom we're probably all familiar, more by repute than
with more than a whiff of sulphur about him.
More than a whiff of sulphur about him, and that's quite interesting. But that's kind of the point I want to make, actually, that we. As though Cesare Borgia is often seen as a figure who is also a master of the dark arts, going from diabolical triumph to diabolical triumph before his inevitable death and demise. In actual fact, things were very touch and go, and he has great difficulty dealing with rebellious captains who are very dangerous characters, and nobody knows whether they're going to be Cesare's undoing. And Machiavelli is with him in the field and sees him turn it around in a single day. He surprises them. Cesare makes them think that they're going to get what they want, and he has them arrested, and a couple of them are killed, and everything is sorted very quickly. And Machiavelli's account of this is absolutely breathtaking. We have his dispatches from the moment, but he later writes this report, and it makes the hairs on the back of your head stand up. It's good reading and a good insight into his political thought. So I'm going to recommend the lesser works, and for fun, the poems, because no one reads them and they're brilliant.
Well, maybe someone will write a fun account, Machiavelli the Funster or something, seeing as
the Machiavelli joke
every
book.
Other aspect of Machiavelli's life seems to have been written on. But no one's written on it better than you, Alex, and we do recommend Alex's biography, but I think it's not just Alex who recommends Machiavelli. John Buse talked about it. There's been many people at the Engelsberg seminars this year here in sunny Sweden who've recommended the book as one of the absolute lodestars, as we said, of diplomacy, leadership, statecraft. So thank you, Alex, for giving us that authoritative guide to Machiavelli. And now let's go off and read The Prince.
Thank you very much for having me.